Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne, and this is Life After Pulse from WMFE.
Oh my gosh, this has happened so crazy. Like we were all having a great time, and all of a sudden we just heard just gunshots just going back to back, and there were more than 12 rounds. Like I don't know all about guns, but there were way more than 12 rounds. But it was just like back to back to back to back to back. I just ran away.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're safe, and we're trying to get him out of there too. But you know, we have as many officers as we can there right now. Okay.
If officers had gone into those bathrooms, the loss of life would have and could have been even greater. And there was extreme danger to the surviving hostages in those bathrooms if we would have entered. Earlier.
It doesn't matter if you're a police officer that you get shot. It doesn't matter if your partner goes down. You do not stop until you stop the shooter. Period. Full stop. And that did not happen at the Pulse nightclub.
It's been 1 year since 49 people were killed and more than 50 injured after a gunman opened fire at Pulse nightclub in Orlando. In this episode, we'll explore what happened in the club from 2:02 a.m. when the gunman opened fire until the end of the standoff with the shooter, shortly after 5 a.m. What happened in those hours? What was law enforcement up against? And why didn't they end the situation sooner? We're going to hear from people inside the club that night, from interviews after the event to 911 calls talking to people inside the club. While the audio we've selected to air on our station and include in this podcast is only used to convey a sense of what was going on inside, I want to warn you, the calls are difficult to listen to. Discretion is advised. The following timeline is based on documents and 911 calls released by the City of Orlando, interviews with law enforcement officers, and firsthand accounts from witnesses that were inside the club. Around 2 a.m. on Sunday, June 12th, Latin Night was wrapping up at Pulse Nightclub in Orlando. After a night of partying and dancing, around 300 people were paying their taps as bartenders ended the night with last call. The music was loud, the club was dark, and it was small. Outside, 29-year-old Omar Mateen pulled up to the club. Armed with an automatic rifle and pistol, he entered the club and started shooting people inside.
Sunday, June 12, 2016. The time, 2:03 a.m.
Helena Fire.
Hey, it's Bertha. We need you at 1912 South Orange for shots fired. We got multiple people down. We have emergency traffic.
Detective Grueler is working the club that night as extra duty security. At 2:02 a.m., the first shots ring out, and he calls for a signal 43, meaning officer needs help. Victims inside the club flee in multiple directions. To a patio to the east, out a back door north, and some head to the bathrooms west. Detective Grueler fires several rounds at the suspect, who is standing just inside the double doors at the front of the club. Grueler is outside the club, firing inside about a minute after those first shots. That's when the first wave of law enforcement arrives. At 2:05, there's a pause in the gunfire. Then a team of four officers, including Grueler, make their entrance to the club. The gunman, Omar Mateen, moves from the main dance floor to the bathroom, east to west. At 2:08, another team of law enforcement agents enter the club from the east patio and begin rescuing victims from the dance floor. In the sheer chaos of the situation, first responders were trying to get a handle on what was happening, where the shooter was, or if there was more than one, and where the victims were located. They relied on 911 calls and dispatchers like Joe to gather as much information as possible to help law enforcement.
Emergency 911, this is Joe on a recorded line.
Hi, I'm calling because there was a shootout in Pulse, the nightclub.
Yes, sir. Are you there now?
No, my friend's in there right now, and we don't know what to do. He's on the phone with us, and he said the shooter is still inside the building, and he's on the phone with him, and we don't know what to tell him.
Okay, let him know that we have over 15 officers there right now. Did he see who was shooting?
Does he see the shooter? Does he see the shooter? He says he can see the shooter. The shooter's still in the building.
Does he? Can you tell me what he looks like? If he's black, white, Hispanic, Asian?
The caller tells the dispatcher his friend is in the main room on the dance floor.
But let him know the police are there right now, but he needs to stay exactly where he is, okay?
He's not talking? He's not talking anymore, sir.
Okay. We have the officers there right now. Can you hear anything on the phone? Did he hang up or what?
No, he's just there. He's still there. He hasn't hung up. He's just there.
Okay. Well, let him stay quiet.
The dispatcher reassures the caller and tells him again that there are police in the building and to tell his friend to stay where he is or find somewhere safe.
Is he talking to you guys again?
No, he's just really crying. He's just crying.
Okay. Did he tell you if he was hurt?
He said his mom was there. His mom got shot.
His mom got shot? His shoulder. Okay.
Reports from 911 dispatchers show the shooting started again. Victims inside the club are calling for help. Some go silent on the line. Others describe their injuries. They're shot in the arm, shot in the leg. Dispatchers note they can hear screaming, moaning on the lines in between gunshots, sometimes 20 to 30 shots at a time. And then the shooting stops at 2:17. More officers enter the main dance floor. There are so many victims lying on the ground, officers have to ask, if you're alive, raise your hand. They begin pulling victims out. The SWAT team is called. Now, the shooter is with victims inside the bathroom. One hostage contacts 911 dispatchers and says the shooter was reloading his firearm. Because law enforcement couldn't see the shooter, they didn't engage, says Orlando Police Chief John Mina.
So between 2:30 and 3 o'clock, our officers were basically, our SWAT team and officers were set up on the location where we thought the suspect was, but there's a lot more that goes on. Our officers are basically gathering intel around the building, getting the layout, and rescuing people from the rest of the club.
And that's when Orlando Police SWAT Captain Mark Canty arrives at the scene.
My mind was immediately went to the people that were still inside. So I went to the south double doors and I was looking inside, trying to get a picture of how the club was and how we were going to get in there to get those people out and also to stop his violence. So not a very big club. A lot of water around. There's mirrors on the wall, so that kind of messes with your depth perception. It's dark, so just trying to gather some information to see how we're gonna tackle this problem.
I ask Canty what he sees when he looks inside.
I was in the back bar area. You can see the hallway that led down to the bathrooms. You can see the bar area. Just like I said, water and blood and trash just all over the club.
The scene quickly evolved from an active shooter to a barricaded gunman with hostages. There are two bathrooms on the west end of the club, with a small hallway in between them. The entrance to either bathroom is through that hallway. So if you walk down it, there's a door on your right, that's the north bathroom, and a door on your left, that's the south bathroom. Mateen is holed up in the north bathroom, there on your right. At 2:35, the scene takes another turn. Terrorism.
Emergency 911, this is Jessica Lyons, being recorded.
I want to let you know I'm in Orlando and I did the shooting.
What's your name?
My name is, I pledge of allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi of the Islamic State.
Okay. What's your name?
I pledge my allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, Hafidullah, on behalf of the Islamic State.
Where are you at?
In Orlando.
Where in Orlando?
Omar Mateen would make three more calls, those going to a crisis negotiator. At around 2:50, that's 40 minutes after the first shots, Mateen claims to have bombs in his car. Now, this is important to remember because initially, police say the threat of bombs stopped officers from approaching. Later, Mateen would say that he has a vest and he would attach them to hostages. Captain Canty has been with OPD for 17 years. After Columbine, the SWAT team trained the entire police department, utilizing brand new unoccupied school for training. The team also looked at situations like the Moscow Theater, Mumbai, India, Sandy Hook, Aurora, and tried to tailor the training to consider what might happen. Even still, says Canty, this situation was different.
This call went very rapidly from an active shooter to, like she said, like a barricaded gunman, and then to a hostage a hostage rescue. Tactics are completely different. You know, active shooter, you know, we're taught to, you know, kind of press the threat and go after the shooter, and that's the best way and that's the quickest way to eliminate his violent acts and save people. Once you go to a barricaded gunman, we lose some of our advantage because he knows where he's at. We're going into an unknown. He can we call it barricaded gunman because he can barricade the door. He can put obstacles in our way. He can use hostages as shields. So that kind of changes our tactics.
Mateen spoke with 911 and crisis negotiators until about 3:30. Then nothing more from the shooter. During that time, OPD says victims were rescued from the dance floor. More were rescued from an office above the bar, and even more from a dressing room in the club. At 4:09, a caller inside the bathroom says Mateen would strap bomb vests to the hostages. By 4:31, more than 2 hours after victims ran into the bathrooms only to be taken hostage, they call 911, desperate, panicking.
We are in the bathroom in Pulse. There's two people in here that are about to die. There's four already dead. Someone needs to come in here now.
Listen, I understand. And I know you're scared. We have help coming to you, okay? You're in the bathroom.
We've been in here.
I understand. They have to secure the scene, okay?
Can they send someone in here? These two people are going to bleed out. Four is going to turn into six if someone doesn't come in here.
Okay, and you're in the restroom?
Yes.
Which restroom?
Can we walk out with our hands up?
No, we're not telling you to do that yet.
No. Someone needs to get sent in here then. Someone, okay. Just one person, someone, a paramedic, someone needs to come in here.
What is your name? How many people are in there?
There's about 15 of us.
15?
Four are dead. Yes.
And how many are deceased?
One, two,
one,
three,
two.
Four that I can see.
Okay.
And then one and two are about to bleed out. Talk to me.
It's during this hour that law enforcement feared there might be more loss of life if the shooter had bombs, and the decision was made to go after the shooter and rescue the victims. Here's SWAT Captain Mark Canty.
The plan was to breach an exterior wall on the south bathroom and rescue as many people as we could before he did anything else violent. I think what probably people don't realize is the entire time while we're doing this and preparing this, there's a team that's ready. If he starts shooting again, there's a team that's on standby immediately, and they know if they hear gunshots, they're to go. So, and they don't need any further instruction from me or a team leader or anything like that. They know if they hear gunshots, they're to go.
Canty needs to figure out what the walls are made of and what kind of explosives his team will need.
I go back to the command post, and I kind of brief the chief, tell him what we have, tell him where I think people are, based on the information we're getting. There's only really two options for us. You know, do we breach the north bathroom and go after the killer, or do we breach the south bathroom and go after more hostages? And the chief immediately says, "Hey, we need to save as many people as possible." So we decided to go after the south bathroom. I let my Lieutenant Smith, who's my field commander at the time, know, "Hey, it's a go. Just let me know when you're ready and give me a countdown."
At 5:02, SWAT breaches the wall. There's explosions. They use a large truck to ram the wall. Shots fired again. They engage the shooter. And at 5:15, 3 hours after the shooting started, Mateen is dead. 49 victims are also dead. 13 in total from the bathrooms, 1 on the patio, 1 in the front lobby, 3 on the side of the club. 9 died at the hospital. Another 2 at triage before they could even make it to the emergency room. And 20 lives were lost on the dance floor that night when the shooter opened fire during the deadliest mass shooting in recent U.S. history. In the days and weeks after the Pulse shooting, attention turned to the response of law enforcement. Police face questions about delayed response to Orlando shooting, writes a headline from the LA Times, not even 24 hours after the incident. A survivor tells the Washington Post, quote, "They took too damn long." Chief Mina says the delay was because the situation turned to a barricaded gunman and tactics changed.
That's bullshit.
That's Chris Grolnick. He's one of the first experts to publicly criticize OPD's response. He's an expert in police tactics and served on the SWAT team in McKinney, Texas. Nearly a year after Pulse, I reached out to him via Skype. He remains critical of their response, especially the idea that around 2:20, the situation became a barricaded gunman.
The guy already demonstrated a propensity of violence that he was going to kill people because he already started. They had text messages that people were bleeding out. You can't just say, IQ, touch my shoe, I'm going to barricade myself, you know, please talk me out of this, when you have innocent victims bleeding out. That's why that's BS.
Grolnick explains how police training has changed since the Columbine shooting in 1999.
There's something very important to understand about active shooters. If you have a bank robbery, the police operate under a philosophy of something called POLA, P-O-L-A, priority of lives assessment. And it's something that we have to do in, you know, a hundredth of a second. So if it's a bank robbery and you're inside, we're worried about the victim that's inside. Then we're worried about the innocent bystanders outside. Then we're worried about our safety. And then we worry about the bank robbery. So last on the priority of life is the bank robbery. If that something, you know, were to happen to that person, so be it, right? Last in line. So if you want to see the grotesque sign of an active shooter, you invert POLA, because that's what police officers are being trained to do since 1999 after Columbine. The number one priority is stopping the shooter. It doesn't matter if you end up shooting someone else on accident. It doesn't matter if you're a police officer that you get shot. It doesn't matter if your partner goes down. You do not stop until you stop the shooter. Period. Full stop. And that did not happen at the Pulse nightclub.
I spoke with Chief Mina about 10 months after Pulse and asked him about that criticism. Mina argues that because there was no shooting at the time, the situation was not an active shooter. Instead, it was a hostage situation with Mateen having the tactical advantage.
Well, certainly if you could picture yourself in a 141-square-foot bathroom with one entrance and you're surrounded by hostages, you know how the officers who are going to do the rescue are coming in. The advantage is to that suspect and that shooter. So, as I said, obviously, once that door would have opened, I'm sure he would have opened fire on our officers, and our officers, trying to protect their lives, would have had to return fire into that small bathroom area, putting the hostages at grave risk.
So everyone was at risk in that particular
Everyone was at risk, yeah.
The Pulse shooting forced many police agencies across the country to evaluate their training and level of preparedness for a mass shooting incident. Chief Mina and his staff have taken a close look at the response, and they have been talking with other law enforcement agencies about best practices and lessons learned. But Mina says there's not much to change at the Orlando Police Department in the wake of the shooting.
No, we haven't had to change any policies. I'm very confident in not only our policies, but are the abilities of our SWAT team and the responding officers at night.
Most criticism of the OPD stems from the decision to not engage the shooter when he was barricaded in the bathrooms, and instead approach it as a hostage situation, despite the fact that the shooter didn't mention a bomb until 50 minutes after the first shots.
I would say that, again, if officers had gone into those bathrooms, the loss of life would have and could have been even greater. And there was extreme danger to the surviving hostages in those bathrooms if we would have entered earlier.
I asked Chief Mina if he regrets that decision.
No.
Not at all.
No.
A year out, and the investigation into the shooting continues. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement conducted an investigation and has sent the findings to the state attorney's office. The FBI is investigating ballistic evidence and whether any victim was hit by friendly fire.
To this point, there is no indication that any victim was killed with friendly fire, but that part of the investigation is continuing.
While Grolnick remains critical of the response, he does not blame the officers that responded that night.
I think the number one thing is you don't know how you're going to act until you're in the field of fire. And for somebody to Monday morning quarterback the officers trying to do the right thing, it shouldn't happen. It's bad, and I'm not doing that. But if you don't question the leadership, then you're just as grotesquely negligent as the leadership was that night, in my professional opinion.
Just days after the shooting, Chief Mina asked the Department of Justice to review the actions of the OPD in what's called an after-action review, although it's unclear when that will conclude. What is clear is that Omar Mateen killed 49 innocent victims, injured more than 50 people, and risked the lives of over 300 local law enforcement officers that showed up that night. I asked SWAT Captain Mark Canty if he ever expected a night like this when he took the job almost two decades ago.
Yes, because I think I look at this job as a calling, and I think if you have paid attention to the world over the last 30 or 40 years, there's been an increase in it. And I think the men and women that put on this uniform, they know what they're getting into. They know that they're going to go out and have to face, you know, the worst of our society or the worst that's out there in the world. So, absolutely. You know, I come to work every day because I want to be the person that stands up against evil. So.
Find more of our Pulse coverage at our website, WMFE.org. Music used in this episode from Bortex and Kevin McLeod. And a very special thank you to local artist Ishmael Perez for his music contribution. It's his piano interpretation of the song Love Make the World Go Round by Jennifer Lopez and Lin-Manuel Miranda. I'm Brendan Byrne. This is Life After Pulse.